Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia of being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free.
From Wondery.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing great, Justin. Thank you for asking.
Awesome. We haven't seen each other in a while. We have our shop, genypod.com, where you can purchase our merchandise. Tonight's case is the Jeremy Bamber of New Zealand. It's the Stephen Avery of New Zealand. And what are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Well, it's known as the Bain Family Murders. At the center of this is a man by the name of David Bain, who at the time was 22 years old. The murders took place on June 20th, 1994 in New Zealand.
And for anyone that's wondering, New Zealand is a little bit smaller than the state of California. So this is a big deal there. This was huge news and still is big news to this day.
Right. Let's give a summary of what happened that way. As we go through the case, you have an idea where we're going with it. On the morning of June 20th, 1994, David Bain got up and got ready to go out on his paper route. Now he's 22 and has a newspaper delivery route that he goes on. And he supposedly goes on this paper route. And then when he returns, starts washing some clothes, takes a shower. And then he discovers that some members of his family have been killed. At the time, he says that he knew of, what, a couple of them?
His parents. And he calls 111, which is the equivalent of 911, the emergency number. And he says they're all dead.
Yes, and this call takes place, it's estimated, about 25 minutes after he had returned home from his route.
Yeah. So he returns home around 6:45-ish.
And then the 111 call comes in at 7:09. That's about 25 minutes.
Police and emergency services show up.
It's just after 7:30.
Yeah. David is pretty much in the fetal position, crying and not really responsive to EMS and emergency workers. It turns out his entire family's been murdered. And who are all the victims?
Well, the victims are his immediate family. His father, Robin Bain, was 59 years old. The rifle used to kill each and every family member was found next to his body. Margaret Bain, who was 50 years old. Arawa was 19. She was the eldest daughter. The next daughter was Lanyette. She was 18. And then David's younger brother, Stephen, was 14.
And Stephen, that one was more than just shooting. It looked like there was struggle and fight.
There was a physical confrontation.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a shooting.
Whoever the murderer was struggling with Stephen.
Initially, investigators are looking at the scene. They have the eldest child of the couple, who's 22, and he supposedly has returned home from doing his job. And the rifle is laying there next to the father. And at first, it looks like it's a murder-suicide.
Now, this .22 rifle has a silencer or suppressor on it. Kind of reason why somebody could go around the house and gun people down and not alert others as quickly.
Right. And it's noted that around 7 in the morning, a neighbor was awoken by a barking dog from within the house. There was a dog. The dog's name was Casey, and it actually belonged to one of the daughters. When investigators were at the house, it was strange because the dog wouldn't go near David. The dog would stay behind other people and watch him warily. But that's just something that was noted. Don't have video footage of it.
There's a lot of witness testimony in this case that may or may not have any weight or any substance to it or any credit.
For anyone that's listening, I'm sure that you've watched a documentary before, and some would call it spin or presentation. But if you see or hear something, you'll take it in the way you take it in. So for some people, they would say, oh, they're just trying to make David look bad. And someone else would say, oh, come on, dogs sense evil.
Yeah. I don't put any weight on whether the dog was doing this or not, because my dogs, if there's a thunderstorm, they're going to stay away from me and everybody because they're scared and they're going to be under the bed. So this was their interpretation of a thunderstorm, and the dog could just be scared.
People coming into the house that the dog's not familiar with, but, and we don't know, perhaps David was never close to that dog anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't say, oh, they used to pal around all the time and he would take it for walks. We don't know. So it may not be important. It may be important. We can't say.
Yeah.
As they start going through the evidence, there's a .22 rifle involved that has a silencer. They also note that on the computer, there's a note. And this is actually typed into the computer. So it's not like a note that's like a post-it note or anything. It's not been stuck to the computer. It's actually on the,
it's like
on the computer.
Word or notepad or something's been opened and this has been written.
And it says, sorry, you're the only one who deserved to stay.
So the father, Robin, obviously went through and killed everybody when he knew David was out doing his paper route and he deserves to stay because he was the only person in the family that was doing something good and working and is an upstanding citizen and his father loved him. But the rest of these kids, no, David's the only one that deserved to stay and the father did it. That's what we're supposed to believe in this case. The scene looks fairly straightforward, but they find a lot of other items. They find bloody footprints in the hallway. They find bloody clothing down in the laundry room. They find blood smears on the soap box to the washing machine. They find fingerprints in blood on the rifle. So we have a lot of evidence here, a lot of different things that can shed some light on what went down that morning. You want to start with the bloody footprints?
Well, the footprints were basically sock print. I mean, they were sock prints.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like an outline of a foot. It was an outline. They were prints left behind by socks that had
stepped in blood. With that, you don't have a shoe print to say, these were David's shoes, these were Robin's shoes. By the way, that's pretty much the two theories that are going here are it was either the father, Robin, or it was David, the son, that committed these crimes. So we have a sock print, and Robin's foot size was 270 millimeters, and David's was 300 millimeters, so about 30 millimeters difference. And the bloody footprints were somewhere kind of in between that, like what's 280, 290. So bigger than Robin's, but smaller than David's. So then there's the bloody clothes in the washer. One of these articles of clothing is a jersey or what we would call a sweater that belonged to David. And there was blood on the shoulder.
Well, there's a question with who it belonged to. And depending on when David was asked, he gave two different answers.
Mm-hmm.
He said that his father wore it, but he also said that his sister wore it.
Okay.
Now, this sweater, there was also talk about whether it was man-made or machine-made, and that would determine how well it would go through a washing machine, because it was said by people that knew the family that they would hand-wash jerseys.
Mm-hmm.
They could clean them without risking damage to the jersey.
So there's blood on this jersey. So it can be assumed that the killer, the murderer, probably was wearing this jersey.
They also believe that because there's a blood smear left by this jersey on, I believe, a doorway.
Mm-hmm.
That's a clue.
They also found a bloody handprint on the washing machine, and they found a blood smear on the soapbox.
Right. And the handprint is actually a palm print, and it was identified as being David's.
Okay. So David has blood on him.
The other thing is these clothes were bloody when they were put into the wash. That's supposedly how his hand got bloodied. Again, how the soapbox had blood on it.
So I'm confused. Is it his father or sister's sweater, or is it his sweater? Why would he?
He was doing the wash.
Yeah.
And one of the ways to explain this is that his parents weren't getting along. And this is kind of where we have to talk a little bit about the past, because when David was young, not long after he was born, David moved with his parents to Papua New Guinea, and they lived there for 15 years. Now, they were supposed to only go for a few years. His father, Robin, was doing missionary work. While they were there, his mother was getting into occultism.
Mysticism, things like that.
And his father was doing missionary work. So you can see how this was a bit odd. When they arrived back in New Zealand, they were sort of going different directions. The father was teaching, and he was basically living at the school through the week. And then on the weekends, he would live in a caravan outside of the home in the yard.
So he's living in the front yard in a little camper thing.
I don't know if it was the front or back. I don't know. But he's living outside in a caravan. David, being the oldest child of this couple, they say he was becoming the man of the house. He was having to take over responsibilities because his parents weren't spending any time together. They were basically living apart.
They were estranged.
You could see why he would be doing the laundry. Stuff needs to be done.
If you see photos of this crime scene, if you see photos of their house, you'll see that they were a very poor family. Their home was in a dilapidated state on the outside. On the inside, it was kind of a mix between a mess and a hoarder's house. It was not well kept. Just to give you a vision of what we're dealing with here. Poor family. The house had been sighted by the city. They were trying to decide what to do because they didn't really have the money to upkeep the house. They didn't really have the money to afford all these children. It's not a good situation. Dad's living in the yard.
And of course, David, perhaps the problems with his parents were affecting him because he didn't really have a job. I mean, yes, he has a newspaper job, but he was unemployed for a time and he didn't do well at university. He had gotten into opera, which he seemed to enjoy, but things just weren't looking so good for him.
You're 22 years old, living at home, doing a paper route. Sucks.
So there are some issues in the family, and like you said, the state of their living environment, not so good. I can only imagine it would make it more difficult to try and investigate it, because you go through, and if you look at the images that are available, look at Stephen's room.
I guess I want to analyze some of this evidence, but we analyze it because the law enforcement, they focus on David. They no longer think this is a murder-suicide. They think it's a murder. And it's because of some of these items they've seen, such as David appears to be the one that has the blood on him, not his father, Robin. And they charge him with this crime. During the trial, they analyze all this evidence. And in some of these pictures, I saw eyeglasses that were missing a lens. So the eyeglasses were in one room, but the lens was in the other room. So
yes, the eyeglasses were found in David's room, where he was when investigators arrived. And then the lens, which I believe was the left lens, was found on the floor of Stephen's room. They tracked down the story with these eyeglasses. And the story is these are eyeglasses that David would wear when his primary eyeglasses were being repaired.
Because you sit on them, you lose them, you whatever. So these were his backup pair. Now, when I looked at the photos, I have to say that I had to look for the lens. I had to look for the glasses because it was such a mess. It was such a mess to the point where I was wondering to myself, was anyone wearing these eyeglasses or were they broken and just left in this state for weeks? I couldn't tell, but the prosecution's theory is David was wearing these, and during the physical altercation with Stephen, they were broken. The defense's theory is Robin was wearing them for some weird reason.
It's curious because, as we all know, eyeglasses, they're made for a certain person.
Yeah, prescription eyeglasses.
I could take my wife's eyeglasses and put them on, and I would essentially be blind, and I would probably get a headache. Yeah. So I can't just put on her eyeglasses. What would be the purpose?
Yeah.
It doesn't really make sense.
Yeah. Either A, he was wearing them and they were broken, or B, they were broken prior and just laying around. But David never really makes statements to that they were broken prior and laying around. So I kind of got to go with A on that one.
Yes, it doesn't look good for him on the eyeglasses. And tied into that, he had some marks on his face, which they say look like they could have been made if someone struck those glasses off of his face.
Huh. I'm sure he received those marks on his face from his paper route, though. You know, branches and stuff might have hit him.
There's no real explanation for his injuries, as they would be called.
Okay.
Now, that's something else. When you look at his father, Robin, and then you look at David, the injuries are a completely different story. So Robin, his only injury is he was shot in the head. That's all they could find with him. But when it comes to David, he had bruising and he had scratch marks. How would he have gotten injured? And he doesn't have an explanation for where these injuries came from. When you're taken to a police station and they are concerned about a suicide risk, they will have you change out of your clothes into...
they're like paper thin clothes. It's pants and a top, and you can't twist it together and hang yourself with it or anything. It's just, they would tear apart.
I think they call it a suicide gown.
Okay, suicide gown. That was the word.
So he was made to strip, and then when he had taken off his top, they said that there were scratch marks and there were bruises, mostly around his right shoulder. The marks stood out as they appeared to be left behind by fingernails.
Somebody grabbing or digging in or trying to fend off.
Right. And they asked him how he got them, but he wouldn't respond to them. So he didn't answer the question.
Oh, everyone fights with their siblings all the time, right? I mean, that's reasonable. Got into his fight with one of his siblings earlier that week.
So he had some other injuries, but suffice it to say, he looks like he was involved in something. Whereas Robin, his father, was untouched save for being shot in the head.
And something about that head injury, he's laying on the floor and his head is leaning back. And you see the blood trails down his forehead and going down his head. And there's multiple blood trails, meaning his head looks as if it was moved. So you have to think, he shot himself in the head, he fell down, and then his head, under its own weight, shifted, and then the blood went that way as opposed to how it was flowing the first way. Or did somebody move him after he was murdered? Why did his head move after death? Can we talk about the bloody socks next? 270 is Robin and 300 is David. So there's 30 millimeters difference. Robin's on the short side. David's on the long side. The bloody footprints left in the hallway were somewhere in between. So the defense took people wearing socks, dipped them in pig's blood, and then made them step on carpet. They dipped them in pig's blood, like, and saturated them with blood, and then had them pressed down completely. So if you imagine, the bloody footprint turned out to be much larger than the actual foot. So the defense says, well, Robin's foot was 270, and these bloody footprints were around 280, 290-ish. So therefore, it was Robin's footprint that left this and not David's, because David's foot would be too large. Now, you know, when you, if you've ever had your fingerprints taken by the police, they roll your entire finger out and get the entire print. But if you were to just grab a glass or something, what kind of fingerprint do you leave? It's much smaller. And when you step down on carpet, everyone has a different step. I used to walk on my toes as a kid, so I did not walk distributing all my weight across my entire foot, trying to make the biggest footprint I could. When you're walking around naturally, you have a completely different step, and your step is going to be smaller than your footprint. So is this Robin or is this David's? Well, who was wearing bloody socks and who wasn't, Aaron?
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
Well, that's easy because Robin's socks had no blood on them.
And he was wearing shoes when he was found with a bullet wound in his head. He was wearing socks and shoes with no blood on them.
You would think by wearing shoes that would prevent blood from getting to the soles of your feet or to the bottoms of your socks.
All right. So I don't know how this bloody sock thing shows it was Robin, but that's what the defense said.
You pointed out that when you walk, you don't always step with your full foot. It's easier to leave behind less of your foot than more, right? Yeah. How would you leave more of your foot? If a print is larger, too large to be someone's, and you say, well, it's too small to be this other person's, they just haven't taken into account that when you walk, you don't always step on your full foot.
In other words, the test they did was complete BS and didn't really show anything. To me, it's inconclusive what they did, because they did not recreate a natural step. So the test was bogus.
So we said that there were clothes in the washer that were bloody. Here's something that amazed me. Now, we have to go back here for a moment, just because this was a case that I didn't know about prior. I know a lot about true crime cases. I've got hundreds, maybe thousands in my head. This is not one I had in my head.
It's New Zealand. I mean, we just didn't pay that much attention to what went on over there. I'm sorry, people.
But we had multiple people writing in over time.
Yeah.
And they kept saying, you've got to look at this case. And so I was pretty well surprised when I found out that when they analyzed the clothes that David was wearing, that they found droplets of blood and they were able to identify the source of those droplets.
Stephen, his brother. Now, Robin didn't have anyone's blood on him at all. And if we go back to David's statement, it was he entered the house, he went and washed clothes, and he did not know or did not see his other siblings. He only knew about his parents being murdered. So how did he get Stephen's blood on his clothes? And why doesn't Robin, the alleged murderer here, have Stephen's blood all over him?
Even the strap that was on the .22 rifle was soaked in blood.
So they found some fingerprints on that rifle, and they said that the fingerprints appeared to be in blood that was splattered on the rifle. And those fingerprints belong to David, not Robin. His fingerprints could have been on it because it belonged to him. But how do fingerprints show up in blood on a rifle? You would have to assume that the rifle was used in the murder and then David touched the rifle. He never says he handled the rifle, but his fingerprints are on it. Are Robin's fingerprints on it?
They're not.
What?
Robin's fingerprints are not on the rifle at all. Now, this is curious because Robin's not wearing gloves. He has gloves, but he's not wearing them. David has gloves, but those gloves were soaked in blood. One of them, I believe, if not both, were found under Stephen's bed. And you would think if Robin shot himself with this rifle, which has a silencer on it, that he would have had to have left some kind of a fingerprint on the rifle somehow.
The prosecution says the rifle was too big, and this rifle is fairly long, and with the suppressor on it, it's a very awkward way. You would have to shoot yourself in the head with this rifle. But the defense did a demonstration of how you could do it by putting the rifle butt on the ground or on a chair, and then you could hold the barrel while you pulled the trigger with your other hand against your head. It looks very unnatural. It doesn't look like a way somebody would actually do it. It would be much easier to put it under your chin or other ways. But it is possible with this rifle if you handled the rifle, but Robin's fingerprints aren't on it.
There was also a 10-round magazine. There were two magazines that went with this rifle. The 10-round magazine was standing up, which doesn't seem possible. If he were holding it and shot himself, I don't know why he would be holding it while he shot himself, but if it were to fall and land that way, that would be, I mean, what are the odds on that?
It looks like it was placed there, is what you're saying.
Which would be manipulation of the scene,
yes.
I would think.
Yeah.
But I don't know why someone would do that.
There is imprints on Robin's hand that one could assume were from the magazine. The magazine had like little dimples or the shape of it, and it appears that his hand could have been gripping or shoving that magazine into the weapon because there's markings on his hand. But I can't say that the markings are an exact match. The defense says, dude, look, there's markings on his hand, and it appears those markings could only come from the magazine. So therefore, Robin handled the gun or the magazine.
Money would have had to have handled it that day, I would assume.
Yeah.
There are a lot of comparison images that you can see online of this, and they look like an exact match for when you take your thumb and forefinger and you push that magazine in.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's odd that they can't find any prints on the rifle. It's not as though the rifle is completely cleaned off. I mean, no. We already said there are bloody fingerprints from David on there. and there are no prints at all from Robin. There's another curious thing about this case, which is when they examined Robin, they discovered that he had a full bladder, which you know how it is when you have a full bladder, you tend to want to urinate.
Well, so this was early morning. Usually you get up and you get dressed or you go to the bathroom first thing in the morning. And it appears that he hadn't gone to the bathroom yet.
No, but they assumed that he went and got the newspaper before he went to go into the house. And from what we understand, Robin's routine was to get up, and then about 7 o'clock, he would go from the caravan to the house.
And he'd pick up the paper, and then he'd go in the house and pray and do his morning routine, right?
Right. So even though he didn't sleep in the house, he did still sort of live there.
Yeah. And the den was considered somewhat his area where the computer was, but the computer was considered David's, something to that effect. It's kind of interesting that they have to distinguish what areas of the house belong to who. Kind of goes to show again how this family was getting along when this side of the house is mine and that side of the house is yours. David said he controlled the computer and he would allow the other siblings to use it in a short window in the morning to check their email or do whatever. So,
and that's a real question because you have this note on the computer. Sorry, you're the only one who deserved to stay. But some people have pointed out that Robin's background, his educational background, as well as his teaching, would suggest that he wouldn't leave a note like that. When you think about it and you think about what this note is supposed to suggest, it's supposed to suggest that the father is stating to his son that he's the only one who deserves to live, basically. There's not really anything to suggest that if he was going to spare anyone, if he was the killer, that it was going to be David.
They didn't get along.
It just doesn't make any sense.
There is actual witness testimony that says David did not like his father and they did not get along. And David was closer to his mother.
And David was becoming the man of the house.
Yeah.
Stephen, on the other hand, got along with his father. Why would he get into a big struggle and end up murdering his youngest son?
But a counterpoint, they say David got along with his oldest sister and they were very close. So why would David kill his sister?
But going back to the note.
Yeah.
When you say you are the only one who deserved to stay, it doesn't quite fit. He could have typed, you are the only one who deserves to stay. Not deserved. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's a past tense, present tense, kind of weird.
It's a mix.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't make sense for someone who supposedly can teach English.
Yeah.
Now, if you're someone who fails at university, or and I'm sure just the average person walking around probably would have difficulty at times if they're not paying attention, if they're typing something really fast, that's the kind of note you might leave. But not someone who would teach English.
Yes.
Or would be considered an English major. And why not just write the note? You have to remember, this is 1994. You go to boot up the computer, you're going to sit there and wait for it to boot up.
Windows 3.1 or whatever it was back then.
Yeah, I didn't actually look up to see what kind of computer it was, but you have to wait for it to boot up, and then you have to type the note. And then supposedly, if you believe Robin did this, then he would suicide after that.
That's a nice segue into what is David's alibi here? How does he prove his case that he was not there? There is a witness, a lady that lives in the neighborhood, is driving along, and she sees David on his paper route at 6:50. And that's according to her car clock. Now, it is determined that she set her clock 5 minutes fast so she could get to work on time. So, technically, she sees David at 6:45 a.m., not 6:50. So, you understand the clock's 5 minutes fast. They determine that the computer was turned on or booted up at 6:42 a.m. So, that's 3 minutes before David was home. So David could not have committed these crimes because the computer was turned on and this note was left on it while he was out. And a witness places him outside the home 3 minutes-ish time for David not to be there. Correct?
I thought they had originally said that the computer was turned on at 6:49, but then they determined that it had been turned on earlier. what they had done was they looked at the present time mm-hmm. and they did some sort of back calculation or something for the time it was up or something.
Well, I'm giving and the defenses. I'm giving the defense saying this is his alibi. The computer was turned on earlier before he was home. But when the prosecution analyzes the computer, they say, no, the times are off. And they try to synchronize. And the prosecution, of course, is like, no, actually, it kind of shows that David might have been home. And the defense says, no, it absolutely shows that David was not home. But the defense says the analysis guy that did the timing and the synchronization got it all wrong and that it's all for nothing. Well, if they're claiming that everything this analysis was wrong, then they can't say that the numbers match up in David's favor. All you can say is it's inconclusive. Just like the sock print. You can't have it both ways. You can't say this was a bad test and it's only in our favor. It just doesn't work that way. So they're trying to argue that tests are bad or good, but they're cherry picking and they're not exactly helping their case.
Right. In a case like this, when you have these disagreements over when the computer was turned on and when he was seen and people's clocks aren't quite right, you can just toss some of the stuff out.
Yeah.
We could talk for a while about how likely is it that if Robin committed these murders that he would use a computer to type up a suicide note.
Let's look at that real quick. Robin had no blood on him from anyone else, and he was wearing pretty much clean clothes and shoes and socks. So how does he become the murderer? The defense's theory is he committed these murders, stripped all his clothes off, took a shower, then got dressed, turned on the computer, typed up the suicide message, and then suicide. Pretty much that's the theory, right? Because that's the only way it works.
But again, we have to remind you that it was David who put the clothes in the washer. So if he had stripped out of all the clothes, meaning Robin, the father, he stripped out of the clothes, then he would have just put them where they would be gathered up and then put into the washer. He didn't actually wash them. So to me, that's a risk.
Yeah.
Because there's evidence just sitting around. Why would he do that? Why would he just set them aside to be washed later?
It doesn't make any sense.
The defense says that he wanted to change his clothes so that when he met his maker, he would be dressed nicer. I cannot take this seriously, sorry, because if you look at the clothes he was wearing, I don't see the difference between the clothes he put on, if he did put those on after getting changed, as the defense says he did, and the ones that he was wearing before, supposedly, as they say, that were bloody. Because on one hand, you have clothes that are actually nicer, that are bloody, and then you have these tattered, ratty-looking clothes that he was wearing. I swear, just look them up.
Yeah.
These are terrible. If you think you're going to dress nice to meet your maker... And this is never mind the fact that if he did do this crime, that he just murdered 5 people. He's going to meet his maker, and as long as he's dressed okay, he's going to be okay. And he's not even dressed okay. That's the problem here.
I don't understand the theory at all or assumption here. So you have David that has blood on him, leaves drops of blood, bloody handprints and smears all in the laundry area that he claims he didn't know he had tracked in there and didn't know that his hands were all bloody, and Robin has no blood on him. Let's point out a couple things that maybe were wrong with this investigation, because no investigation's perfect, right? I mean, we want them all to be packaged up all nice and neat and say, here's what happened, and we can backwards engineer all the events that happened this day. But if that were the case, we wouldn't have a podcast.
We're asking them to be perfect.
Every time.
Every time. And they're coming onto scenes that are horrific, that are disturbing, and they're supposed to do everything by the book, as they say. I don't know. How many times have they come across a scene like this? That's my question. How many times have they entered a home where they had 5 people shot to death? And then in a place like this that's, I mean, I would call it filthy.
And this is New Zealand, where this doesn't happen. Their crime rate is pretty low. It's a really nice place to live.
Compared to the United States of America, where we live, where this might, I hate to say it, but this is more common.
Something that I felt was a little interesting about the investigation is they ran the gunpowder test on David's hand. It did not test positive for gunpowder residue, but he had admitted that he'd washed up. So it's not going to test for that. You said it.
Well, let me put it this way. No, I think when it comes to the shower, I say he took a shower.
Oh.
If your prints are on the rifle and your father's prints are not on the rifle, neither of your hands show any gun residue, the gunpowder residue, I'm just going to say it. You cleaned up.
Yeah.
What is he doing in that 25 minutes that he's at home?
Before he calls 111.
Right. He washes laundry and he claims that, well, I just got done doing my paper route. When I was 11, I started doing a paper route. I delivered the Detroit News. And your hands would absolutely get dirty. The front of my t-shirt, if I had a white t-shirt, which, you know, that's bound to happen. You don't always think about it. It will get dirty.
From the newspaper ink, the print.
Right. It just rubs. You're carrying around a big stack of papers. I would deliver to these apartments and I would have to carry big stacks from the car and I would be dropped off. I would have to carry them inside and leave them in the lobby and start distributing the newspapers. And I have to do it pretty quick because someone will take one.
Yeah.
They're just sitting there. You don't have a guard. No one's staying there guarding your newspaper. So you just have to kind of move and get all the papers delivered quickly.
So David's got this ink on him and he wants to clean up, right?
But he's not just washing his clothes. He's taking clothes that are just waiting to be washed.
Yeah.
Which just happen to be bloody. Well, if you're leaving blood on the washer and on the soapbox and other items in the washroom, then you claim you didn't know that you were leaving this blood everywhere?
No, I get it. It's early in the morning. Sometimes I get up before my wife. I don't turn on any of the lights. So I'm going through the house quietly without turning on the lights so I don't interrupt others. So maybe he didn't see the evidence of his family being wiped out. Maybe he didn't see the blood because he didn't turn on any of the lights. But if you look at the conditions of the house, you look at the conditions that this man's living in, you're looking at just the filth, and this guy has to do laundry right then and there when he returns home. That's the time to do laundry, and he admits to that. I'm sorry, but when somebody's dead in your household and the first thing you're doing is cleaning up, that looks really bad. Even if it wasn't intentional, it just looks bad. There's no other way to say it.
We're supposed to point out problems with the investigation.
So they didn't test Robin's hands for the gun residue.
They didn't test it in a timely manner, and they didn't preserve his hands before testing.
Oh, bagging them?
Right.
Yeah.
You're supposed to bag them so that whatever is on the hand stays either on the hand or within the bag.
Yeah.
They didn't do that.
Well, and technically, they should have bagged all the hands of everyone in the family. If we really want them to exclude anybody, they have to do it for everyone in the household. Don't we want that to happen?
We can nitpick the investigation, mm-hmm. but really, if we're going to say anything in David's defense, we'd have to just, let's just give people a list. It's going to be easier.
Yeah.
So you can say that the bloody jersey, aka the sweater, was either worn by Arowa or Robin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that maybe Robin was wearing when the murders were committed, right?
Yeah.
He does have, again, we'll say it, on the forefinger and the thumb, he has marks. They look like two lines,
yeah,
a certain distance from each other, on each finger that look like they pushed a magazine into a rifle. There's no doubt. I looked at all the pictures many times. I kept looking it over and I thought, yes, that's very curious.
Yeah.
And it's unexplained. How could we explain this? We could sit here and talk about it and come up with all kinds of theories, but
that's a simple,
it's all speculation because we just don't have enough information. On top of that, they say he could have worn the clothes and changed them and gotten cleaned up and then shot himself. And then he wouldn't have any blood on himself, aside from his own, which is what they found on him. Are there other things? Well, how reliable is the sock evidence?
Yeah.
We talked about it's probably easier to leave less of your own foot than more. And I would stand by that, but it's still a question. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't quite fit either one.
Yeah.
So you're going to have some people say, ah, that's not enough. You can't You can't use that. Well, fine. You can throw that out.
Well, yeah, it's like any case. If it all hinged on the sock evidence, if the only piece of evidence we had was the marks on his fingers, great. Hey, that's all we have to go on. Let's go with that. But that's not all we have to go on. We have a lot to go on.
And David left the house. He went and did his paper route. We don't have a specific time on when he got home. We have witnesses. We have other evidence, but we don't have anything solid. You don't have a clock next to the front door and have him entering the house and a video camera on it. We don't have anything definitive. You never do.
No.
So, well, all we can do is say there are witnesses who said they saw him at certain times, and you can kind of use that as a guide. We also can use as a guide when Robin normally comes into the house. Now, on the other hand, maybe Robin changed his routine. If this is a day where he decides to shoot all of the people in his family except for David, then perhaps he changed his routine and he came in at a different time. It would have to be different to support David's defense.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to say David's defense because David really doesn't say much. So when we talk about his defense and things that are helpful in his case, then we pretty much have to go by his lawyers. David really just doesn't say anything. I mean, we even talked about earlier when he was questioned about those scratches and he had nothing to say. In fact, there was a witness, a friend of his, who said she was shown those scratches. And when she asked David about it, he didn't say where they came from. He didn't explain the scratches.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
So if you've actually been listening for the last, 30, 45 minutes, all the evidence really points to David and not Robin. So he is found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole until he's served 16 years.
Well, that is the possibility of parole, but yeah. After 16.
After 16 years. So he goes for his first appeal, wins the appeal, and is granted a retrial in 2009. Now, when you hear how that case went down, you find out that the new evidence, which was pretty much the old evidence that was just rehashed about Robin's indentions on his fingers and other things, are what gave the jury that doubt that they needed. But at David's release party, some of these jurors attended it. Apparently, they knew who David was, and that's kind of what jury selection's for, is do you know anything about this case? No. Okay, then you can be an impartial juror. Well, if these people are going to his release party, apparently they're fans of him and they believe in his innocence. That's kind of shady to me. Also, some of them gave statements that they weren't really paying attention during the trial. They weren't actually there to analyze the evidence. And it appears that the trial went much more in David's favor as far as what evidence was considered admissible and which evidence was not. He gets released, and at that point, the prosecution can't retry him now. He's out.
I'm sure there are things that could be considered, but to me, it very much looks like this is it, that they've let it go. To be fair, it's said that the defense team wasn't very confident in the retrial. You want a retrial. You want a second chance. You always want a second chance. But leading up to that second trial, it was obvious they didn't have a lot of confidence in it going his way. 2007 is when the conviction was basically thrown out. So at this point, that's when the retrial is decided. But the retrial doesn't happen, as you said, until 2009. They kept asking for stays. And I think what it means is this is the kind of case where you really want to make sure you go in with a good strategy. Obviously, the first trial didn't go their way. But when you keep asking for stays,
you're building your case.
Right. So it's interesting. If you win an appeal, and I know it's not every time, but it seems like if you win an appeal, you've been able to show something that throws everything into doubt. And you would think that if it's that good, maybe you have something to work with. Even during the trial, they kept applying to get stays or asking for a mistrial. You would think once it got going, you would just do your best, but they appeared to be nervous and doing their best to try and get things just stretched out as long as they could.
So what I've read is he wins and he's let free. New Zealand is divided on how they feel about this. I found a lot of websites that all say he's innocent, and a lot of websites that are not so positive for David. And they say polls say it's about 50-50. And that's pretty interesting that half and half believe differently here. And a lot of evidence or a lot of other things came out after this, such as the 111 call. During the call, people say it sounds like he says something to the effect of, "I shot that prick." There's a lot of different ways that they say, but when you listen to the audio, you can't make anything out of it. I mean, he might as well be, you know, like Judas Priest played backwards here. It just doesn't make any sense. They bring up things in his favor, like what we've mentioned. There's a whole argument going on now. I don't get it. I don't get where people find in his favor, because I don't see the horrible errors in the investigation. It looked like a pretty straightforward investigation to me. It wasn't perfect, but they say they burned the house down because David said it was okay. And they go, well, why would you burn the property down? Because you could reinvestigate and look for more evidence. And I'm thinking they already gathered the evidence. They don't really need the murder scene any longer. It's not necessary, right?
One of the things they point out is that they could have cut out carpet that had bloody sock print on it and saved that as evidence, so that it could be analyzed again later. Maybe they'd have another expert that could better analyze it. Who knows?
Find if there was mixed DNA in there. Whatever.
Well, no, I think it's basically for the measurements.
Okay.
You'd have tangible evidence that they could test. They could measure it. They could analyze it. That's just one example. But it did appear as though David was all too happy to get something out of that property. And the only way you can sell that property is to get rid of the crap on it, which is the house. The house was in poor condition. That's being nice. This is getting into motive, though. You know, the family's dead. You've got one survivor. That property could be sold off. The only thing you will really get out of it is you can sell the property. The land it's on is valuable. But if you have a really crappy, dilapidated building or house on it that's falling apart, which this was.
Condemned, pretty much.
You're not going to be able to sell that.
Why would somebody wipe out their family? Because he was looking to inherit the fortunes of the family, which the fortune is the property value.
That's it.
That's it.
If this family had, this family had saved some money. They were planning to supposedly build a new house. Things were going to change because if they built the new house, Robin wasn't going to continue living in the caravan. Mm-hmm. He was going to have a room. In the current state, he couldn't have his own room in the house.
Yeah.
But if you rebuild, now he can have his own separate room. So the family sort of makes do. The parents aren't together, but now they don't have to worry about sleeping arrangements. It's taken care of.
Do you think that would be a decent motive for David?
I think there's always something more. You know, you can point to financial motives, you can point to the unrest in the family, but for someone to wipe out a whole family like that, I think there's something more going on.
Yeah, I don't think David's sitting there thinking, oh, I'm going to cash in on this property, so I'm going to kill everybody. He snapped. It's a bad situation. He's living in poverty. He doesn't like Robin. If they have to move back into it, you know, if they have to go through building a new house, whatever. I mean, the guy should have been moved out by now. He shouldn't have had to deal with any of these issues. He should have been living on his own, but he's having to because nobody else in the family's able to.
Robin's the only one who can have a job, a real job.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think he's there to be the hero.
No.
I think he's there because he has no choice. You can't make a living off of a paper route. Not the one he has anyway. That's not going to work. I really do think that this isn't a snap. Now, you might say a snap in and, you know, he just got sick and tired.
Yeah, that's what.
But I'm this going seems for. Planned. I think the best way to finish with this is to kind of go over the alleged scenarios by the prosecution and the defense. And that way it kind of lays out how it could have played out, depending on who you see as guilty.
Okay.
Look, if you ask people, if you say, what do you think happened if Robin was the killer? What do you think happened if David was the killer? You could get different answers. There are some things about this case that you could see making different calls on different scenarios, but we'll just give you some ideas here. Robin wakes up, changes out of the clothes he's sleeping in, and dresses in a green jersey that's usually worn by Arawa, his daughter. And then he goes out to the mailbox and he gets the newspaper. And then when he gets to the house, he goes to David's room to get the rifle. Now, the rifle has a trigger lock on it. From what I recall, there were two keys to this thing. One was actually in an overcoat that had been left in, I think, the caravan. Robin wouldn't have known about that. But there's a key that's in a jar of knickknacks in David's room. He would have had to have gone through that jar, probably taken stuff out of it, but he would have returned everything back to the jar because the jar still had the knickknacks in it. It just didn't have the key anymore. Like, the key was used to unlock the trigger guard.
Yeah.
But David himself says that no one else knew where this key was. Only he knew where it was. And then gets some bullets. Giving an idea of how many bullets are available, this kind of surprised me. David had more than 1,000 bullets.
It's a .22, and at the time there wasn't a .22 shortage, so...
You're an American. Anyway, this key is in this pot or jar or what have you, and he unlocks the trigger lock, and then he puts on David's dress gloves. Now, these are dress gloves I believe that he would use when he was in the classical music program, correct?
That's what I assumed, but...
They're these dressy white gloves.
Yeah. There's no other reason for him to have them.
He's using David's gloves, if you believe that he puts them on. He has his own gloves that are in his caravan, but he doesn't use those. Which is interesting because he's going to write a note later. Keep that in mind. So he has a couple of magazines, and he loads one with 5 bullets and another one with 10. And then he goes on his hunt, and he starts with Margaret, his wife, and then he shoots his second daughter, and she's shot 3 times. There's also a struggle with Stephen, who's 14. At one point, a bullet will go through Stephen's hand and go across his head. So it's kind of a miss. It appears as though there was an attempted strangulation with the t-shirt of Stephen. He was later finished off with a bullet. And then Arawa was last to be shot, according to the scenario, was probably in a kneeling position when he entered her room.
Possibly praying?
Praying, begging, who knows? Most people, I think, will say praying because they... That's what they imagine she would be doing.
Sadly, it's a better image because begging just is really sad.
So now, supposedly, he goes back to the caravan, and this is after he had stripped off the clothes and put them near the washer. And he puts on these clothes, which are, like I said, you can look them up. They're terrible looking. They're not anything. If you were going to dress up to meet your maker, as they say, not sure how you would put these on, but this is the scenario they are laying out, that he dressed into these clean, quote unquote, clean clothes.
Aaron, you're not the fashion police, okay?
And decides to shoot himself in the house. So he goes back to the house, type the note, but he knows that his son will be back soon. So I'm sure he's in a hurry.
One scenario that the defense would want you to believe.
But there's another scenario, which is David, who has a paper route, could have, since he knows where the trigger lock key is, could have unlocked the trigger lock and went around. Since the rifle has a silencer, we already established before in other cases, the 22 is not that loud.
No.
You put a silencer on it, he can go around and murder everybody in that house and then go on his paper route. We already talked about how it's understood that Robin wouldn't even come into the house until about 7 a.m. So all David has to do is be in the house before his father gets there. That's it. And then what can he do? He can lay in wait for him.
From the angle of where the bullet entered and exited his father's head, it makes more sense if he's standing there and David's holding the rifle at him. It's just a more natural progression and position than the weird position that he would have had to have held it, because he would have had to like turn his head and put it to this. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. In fact, it might have just been an ambush situation where Robin walked in and David was standing off to the side and just walked up and pow. That's actually more what it looks like to me. And then remember the blood streams on Robin's head. Maybe David kicked him in the head. Maybe David tried to readjust his body or reposition it somehow because it was moved after the fact. Or the police are just totally incompetent and moved his head.
I know we've talked in the past, police make mistakes and you have to hold them accountable. Right. This just is really stretching it at this point, because you have to say that Dave is able to wash laundry and not realize there's any blood. You have to understand that clothing had been soaked in blood. The gloves had been soaked in blood. Whoever was doing the wash was leaving blood everywhere. Left a big bloody palm print on the washer. He doesn't see that. You wouldn't think that would stand out to you at any point in time.
I wish they had an explanation. Even if they would have said he was in shock after seeing his whole entire family wiped out, and then he stumbled down to the washroom to do laundry, like in shock. But they don't even bring that up as a defense.
His glasses, he has marks on his face. The glasses are broken. Those were his spares, his backups.
Yeah.
And people want to say, oh, well, that lens could have been in that room for a long time. No, those were his backups. He needs glasses to see properly. They believe that because he didn't have his glasses, that when he went to shoot, you know, if you believe that he did it, when he went to go shoot Erwa, that he couldn't quite see her. There was a shot that was missed.
And this goes back to something we didn't mention, is in one of his statements, he says he hears his sister making a gurgling sound.
Lagniette.
He says this, but she has a execution wound, like she was shot multiple times, but then there's that final shot that's kind of the kill shot. She wouldn't have probably lived through that one. But he says he heard her gurgling. If you think he did it, then yeah, he heard her gurgling and then he gave her one more. Or you have to believe that she somehow lived through this and was still alive. But then his statement changed about whether he heard it or not, so it's all sort of inconclusive. But that was one of his statements, was he heard her gurgling. And if you look at her wounds, that shouldn't have been happening.
They even asked the pathologist, and he said, yeah, he's never heard of that happening. Someone gurgling after they were murdered.
If they survived, you know, if they lived for any amount of time after a headshot, that amount of time is very small window. So David would have had to have literally walked in right after it was all said and done, right after it was over, to have heard this, if she in fact could have lived for any amount of time after a headshot. He served 13 of his 16 years. Now, not that he would have been paroled on the 16th year, but he's suing for wrongful imprisonment for like $1 million. And the court systems are saying that you have to prove that something was done wrong. And that's sort of an interesting point is the law can actually charge, indict, and convict you and sentence you without ever doing anything wrong, for the most part. It's a really hard argument to say that they dropped the ball here or they dropped the ball there. Even if you're innocent, you can be charged and put in jail or prison, and they did everything by the book. It's just the way it is. So I don't think he's going to win in a civil lawsuit.
Well, there's been recent information on this, and it appears as though he's not getting compensated because they just don't believe, despite the not guilty verdict, that there's enough evidence to show that he was definitely not guilty.
Wow.
There's a question about his innocence. Mm-hmm. So remember, there's plenty of evidence against him here. There's the bloody fingerprints. There's his items being used. It's his rifle. It had a trigger lock on it. He had the key. Dad supposedly writing a note saying you're the only one who deserves to live, but then framing him somehow by using his items, making it look like he did it by killing himself in such an odd way, you know, leaving his glasses the way they were. How does the blood from Steven get on him? You can't erase that stuff. It doesn't matter whether he won in court. Think about it. He got lucky. I don't really understand how they could have found him not guilty. But then again, we've looked at other cases that look pretty cut and dry, and you still have defenders out there saying, oh, that person didn't do it. In this case, I guess we can at least be satisfied that he served 13 years. It's preponderance of evidence. We talked about that before. And in this case, it truly is there.
Yeah.
I know there will be people out there who are upset with us because we're supporting the railroading of David Bain, but
they're not listening anymore. They turned off the episode by now.
Well,
these are the elements that we felt were the most important, and it all falls on the evidence. I do not care about who's supporting who, who's got who's back, what political policies in place. It just, none of that stuff mattered. It's the evidence that matters.
The real takeaway here is this was a miserable house, I think. And you had this unrest because David and his mother were on one side, and he was helping to run the house, and he had Robin outside looking in. And then I think we can say this. I think when you look at it and they're trying to save money to rebuild a house there and to get a room for Robin, I think you have to say that there was hope that things could turn around. One person decided they were done with this, and this was the best way to handle it, because he had no way of making a living on his own. He didn't have the education. He didn't have a way to make money.
He didn't have a way out.
He had no way out except to take everyone out and then scrape up whatever's left, which is the property value.
One thing I kind of disagree with on both prosecution and defense. Defense says Robin wrote the suicide note. Prosecution says David wrote it to frame his father. I think David wrote it to himself. He's telling himself, you deserve this. You deserve to live. They didn't.
He's reassuring himself. Never miss an episode of Generation Y. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you're listening right now. Also, be sure to follow us on social media. Our TikTok is at Gen Y Pod. Our Instagram is at Generation Y Podcast. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app to listen ad-free. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today.
Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.